Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Joe Sempavivo. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Joe Sempavivo. Joseph Sempavivo is president and CEO of Joseph's Light Cookies, a family-owned, sugar-free company business. He also runs the real estate firm Joseph's Premier Real Estate. He is the adjunct professor of finance, business, marketing, real estate, and insurance at Indian River State College and the best-selling author of Madness, Miracles, Millions. He is a graduate of Florida International University and New Mexico State University. He's married with 7 children. At the age of 9, Joseph was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. He found out that he was a diabetic when he read a newspaper article that included symptoms for diabetes. After some blood work and tests, doctors told his parents that he would be lucky to live past the age of 17. In 1986, he founded Joseph's Light Cookies after his father, Larry, knowing how badly Joseph wanted to eat cookies again, experimented until he perfected the perfect sugar-free oatmeal cookie. It was Joseph's first cookie in 7 years, and it was amazing. He begged his father to make more flavors. From their little kitchen in New Mexico, they began baking 170 sugar-free cookies a day and brought them to local grocery stores and businesses for people to sample. Now, Joseph's Light Cookies bakes millions of cookies a day and makes other diabetic-friendly products such as sugar-free pancake syrup. Today, the cookie can be found in numerous countries and nationwide across the United States in stores such as Dollar Tree, Big Lots, health food stores, and major grocery chains across America. Mr. Sempavivo, how are you today? Am I saying that even close to right?
It is Sempavivo. Yep.
Sempavivo.
Always living.
Always living. All right. Excellent. Well, thanks for coming on today. Before we get into the new 2024 campaign strategy, tell us about your cookie company. How'd you get into that?
Well, so I guess the news didn't get out there well enough, and that's on me. But yeah, I sold my company about 3 years ago, but I've made sugar-free cookies for 33 years, plus pancake syrup, and sold it to 47 countries, as you stated, and been in multiple White Houses in cookie jars for presidents to enjoy. And it's been, it was a very interesting time because you get to see firsthand what's happening in the corporate world as well as in the business world. So you get a different perspective and you understand how politics really is involved in every single thing you do.
That's true. Some of the best politicians were business owners or at least business people before they got in there, because those that come straight out of college usually don't know a thing or two about lemonade stands. Were your cookies in all the major food store chains, or was it a specialty item?
Dollar Tree, Dollar General, Big Lots, Whole Foods, Fresh and Easy. Yeah, just literally little tiny mom and pops. So the unique thing, we had our cookies at a $1 price point. You go into any Dollar Tree, Dollar General, 99 cent only, or Family Dollar, and pay the same price. Or you can go to Whole Foods and buy them for $5 to $7. The identical bags of cookies made on the same day. We ultimately were making 12 million cookies a day. That's what we were baking.
Wow.
And so it was just kind of all over. We were selling to all the different retailers and different channels.
Yeah. Is it a good business? Are the margins high, or is inflation taking a toll now?
Very tight. Oh, yeah. I remember we were paying $5 a bag, a 50-pound bag of flour. That dollar amount rose to 22. So this was $22 a bag. You have to pass that on to your customer. Well, we did not do that. I promised all my retailers that if they locked in a price, that would be their price for our entire relationship. So whenever I bought had a higher price for flour, like I was buying it at $13. As it went all the way down to $5 or $5.50, I was putting that money in a bank account and just keeping it in there. And that was for all commodities. So then when prices went up, I was able to tap that money without ever having to raise prices. And in the whole time of being in business, never raised the price one time. But that, in today's market, with the inflationary pressures firing on all cylinders between gasoline, insurance costs, taxes, property taxes, I wouldn't be able to do that today.
Who bought the company?
So I have a non-disclosure, obviously, now, but it's a gigantic company.
Okay. So you have 7 children. Talk about gigantic
now
family.
I have 8.
Yeah, 8 now. Okay. All right.
Yep.
All right. How do you make it through the day with all that big brood at home?
My wife, she wears a cape. She's amazing. We homeschool all 8 of them.
Wow.
So we're very blessed. Our 16-year-old and our 14-year-old are enrolled full-time in college, taking 19 credit hours, both 4.0 students. So they should be graduating with their associates in the next 12 months, and then they'll go on for their bachelor's degree.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. So I read eating less sugar can reverse chronic diseases in children in as little as 10 days. Was that the science behind your cookies?
It was. Being a diabetic, I wanted something, but for, satiating, enjoyable. Then we got into Weight Watchers and the Atkins program. But then you just find inflammation. Sugar causes inflammation. So you can eliminate or greatly reduce that inflammation just by watching what you eat.
All right. So is there anything unique about your distribution model or other business practices that kept them ahead of the Oreos or Famous Amos's or Grandma's or any others? I'm sorry to dwell on this. I know we have other things to talk about, but I'm fascinated by the cookie business. Not that I want to get into it. Was there anything unique about your distribution model?
Originally, and I love this question because originally we did a high-low pricing. We came out with an 11-ounce bag. We sold them for $3.99 at traditional IGA stores, the Krogers of the world. And then we knew down the road that we would launch our cookies for $1. So that was from the very beginning of time. We wanted to establish our price as a gourmet, higher-end product, but then do something that our competitors could never afford to do, and that would reduce their price to compete with ours. We knew entering the market at $3.99, our competitors eventually would crush us because they could afford to go down to $2.50 a bag, and we wouldn't be able to compete in a traditional environment. But we got started at $3.99. And I met with my dad and my mom, and I said, look, I want to do a high-low strategy. We want to go in there at $3.99, and then we want to just pull the rug out from underneath the market and give our customers a phenomenal deal and drop it from $3.99 down to $1. And then the traditional cookies would never be able to catch up with us without driving their shareholders crazy and all their stakeholders. And there would be rioting at their company's headquarters. So we prevailed. Out of 36 companies, about 33 discontinued their product lines. The other existing ones really enhanced it, dropped their prices, made them more affordable for the customers. So it turned out to be a win-win all the way around.
And you were a regularly scheduled item on QVC for 6 consecutive years. I think your first day you sold 3.6 million cookies. So at $1, that ain't bad.
Oh, yeah. It was an amazing experience.
And the factory, if not already done, went under a $3.25 million expansion from 44,000 square feet to 52,000 square feet to meet the needs of the diabetic and health conscious market of the world for sugar-free and fat-free products. The bakery produces more than 2.5 million cookies a day, and I guess now is 12.3 million a day.
Right.
And at age 17, you were presented the American Success Award by President George Bush in a White House ceremony. Was that your start in Republican politics?
Oh, yes. I was always involved because my mom and my dad, and being involved in business, I mean, my dad drug me to one event after another. He said, "Son, you always have to speak your mind. It's part of your First Amendment. You have to be there. You have to speak honestly and let them know what you're really experiencing. It doesn't matter what political party, you just always need to be truthful about what you're going through." So, throughout my youth, I was always involved politically, and it just went with me. 17, it was just one of those moments that was surreal. I'm in the White House, a Rose Garden ceremony, and I'm with people like George Strait and George, oh gosh, I just forgot his last name. But anyway, George Shin, owner of the Charlotte Hornets basketball team. And he's like, I just want to sneak out the back door because I just didn't feel like I belonged there. It was just an amazing thing. But all because of love out of from my mom and dad. I mean,
That's awesome.
that's and you never think we were going to share it with all the different diabetics across the world. It was kind of a cool thing.
Which is a great segue to my next question, because your second product was My Mommy's Cookies. A company was organized to provide 100% of the profits to fulfill a guaranteed minimum pledge of $10 million to New Mexico State University's Cancer Research Project. Did you reach the $10 million goal?
Yeah, we did not. It was they ended up at New Mexico State not launching that program, but I think whatever they did, I mean, they developed this magnificent center for business, Arrowhead Center. But we wound up earmarking the funds to Children's Research for Cancer. And was sending it to different institutions that
That's
were
good.
focused on medical research for pediatric cancers.
But they still went ahead and didn't they name business school the Sempravino School of Business, New Mexico State
No, I don't
University?
know if I don't know if they did that.
Oh,
I have no
okay.
idea. I know they were doing that. They said they were going to announce that, but I don't know if that ever happened or
Okay.
not.
Well, now getting into the meat of it here, we're pretty hard on the Department of Education here because they are, so biased and political. You work with them on an initiative to promote healthful eating in schools. What did you take away from that experience in the Leviathan? And we hear a little bit about Michelle Obama's three square meals of rice, whatever it is. But what did you take away from that experience?
If you want, I think it's a fantastic program if you want to study inefficiency at its finest and just the lack of understanding of what's really happening in communities. Look, everything needs to be localized. If you want to empower people, empower the parents, that's really the design that we should be focused on. Not some bureaucracy from your community 3,000 miles away that dictates what you should be eating or not eating. It just, to me, it's just kind of an archaic, inefficient model, very Keynesian. So we're looking at John Maynard Keynes just throwing inefficiencies into the system. I'm definitely Smithsonian here. I just believe in Smith and laissez-faire. Take your hands off. Let the people do it. They'll do it much better. And they're going to know what their local community wants to eat, and let them eat what they want to eat.
Yeah, schools are the ultimate incubator for exactly that. Okay, so you and your dad, Lawrence, wrote the book Madness, Miracles, Millions, the story of his family success. Did you enjoy the writing process, and what lessons did you want leaders to come away with about you and your family?
So Madness, Miracle, Millions was we wrote it for because we realized that our story was not unique. My dad crushed his arm in a printing accident. He couldn't work. They didn't have really any money. And my dad owned a little printing company after he crushed his arm. He opened that up. Long story short, I mean, we came from a very poor family. My dad went bankrupt and owned a handshake because he owned a restaurant. On a handshake, he paid every single person back, even though he didn't have to, because my dad believed our last name was the only thing that would carry I'm out of this world when we die, and money doesn't matter. Your name is what matters. Your word is what matters. So he filed bankruptcy. He shook everybody's hand, all the debtors' hand, and or creditors' hands, and he said, "I will pay you back." They laughed. They discounted him. About 6 or 7 years later, my dad did pay every single person back. But when we start the cookie company, we absolutely had no money. My dad, one day we were sitting around the table, my mom, my dad, myself, and he said, "Wouldn't it be nice?" And my wife was, you know, obviously there. "Wouldn't it be nice if we shared our story with other people that have experienced the same thing? We have the ability to put this down in 192 pages and share it with everybody of our hardship." So many times we hear, Steve, that people just, they opened up a business and they were born with money, like they owned a printing press of cash. And that's not true. For the 31, 32 million small business owners out there in this country, it's a struggle every single day to pay their bills. And they have a massive amount of stress. You don't get to leave the work, or, you know, leave your work and shut off the lights and flip the switch that you're stress-free now and you go home. No, it doesn't work like that. You go home, you pay your employees before yourself, you pay your utility bills and everything else before you pay yourself. So my dad was like, this is an opportunity for us to share this great story. And we won 13 national and international awards, and just kind of really cool to be able to write it down. All my kids have a copy of it, and they read it, and they're amazed. I didn't realize this much about you and Pop-Pop and Mom-Mom and Mommy. I just didn't understand any of that. And some of these things were deeper issues, but my 16, 14, and 12-year-olds so far have read it. And they said it changed their life. They really understood. They said, "We're looking around at what you have now. We thought you always had that. We didn't know your mom's, you know, Mom skipped meals because there was no food in the house and she wanted to feed your brother, your sister, and yourself first. You're diabetic, insulin, didn't have health insurance. So that money that they made was to buy medical supplies. So they had to skip meals." My son said, my kids said, "We never knew you went through that. And you work so hard and you're so, you know, you're so dedicated to working." And I said, "Well, that's because when you have nothing, you really appreciate having something."
That is so true. Okay, everybody. Madness, miracles, millions. Check it out. The story of his family's success. Okay. So you lived in New Mexico, Florida now. Last thing on that, they have one of the hottest races in the country right now, which is unusual for there. Speaker McCarthy was just there for Harrell to retake her seat. I guess she lost to a Dem, Gabe Vasquez, in District 2. Any comments on that before we talk Florida and DeSantis?
Yeah, she served for 2 years in the U.S. Congress and was a fantastic candidate, truly represented the people. You know, New Mexico is a very interesting state. I was economic development commissioner there for 12 years. I was appointed by a Democrat, believe it or not, Richardson, that served under the Clinton administration as UN secretary. We did not see eye to eye at all politically. But, you know, for business, he was very pro-business. He believed in lower taxes and believed in reduced regulation for businesses. I could never understand a lot of the things that he did politically. But then Susana Martinez got elected and Harrell ran, Representative Harrell, Congresswoman Harrell ran for office and got elected, and Susana Martinez for governor was running. So even though I was living in Florida, I think I was the first ever to be appointed and confirmed by their state Senate Ethics Committee. And I didn't live in the state. I fled the state because it just was getting so bad, regulatory wise. It just was not a state I wanted to align with. But the state of Florida is where I'm at now, and I'm hoping I get to stay here, live here, and die here because I love what I see so far.
Whatever happened to Bill Richardson? I know he got a public dressing down by Senator Byrd from West Virginia, which was pretty brutal. You could see it online. Did that end his career? Not good when a former Grand Wizard of the Klan says your political career is over.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I, he fell off the face of the earth. I mean, he essentially stopped answering calls from people and just climbed into the cave, and it has stayed there ever since.
Yeah. We only ever hear about Arizona in the news with their immigration crisis and election funny business. Next door, New Mexico, is everything A-okay?
No, far from it. So my niece, so I grew up in a town of Deming, 18,000 people, really small town, 30 minutes from the Mexican border, Palomas, Mexico. That's about an hour and a half from Juarez, Mexico, or El Paso, Texas.
Yikes.
And it's all the same. Whether you go to Juarez, Las Cruces, or Deming, you experience the high crime, the high drug rate, high unemployment, massive welfare use. It's bad. My community, my cookie company, had a really hard time hiring people. About 38% of the community was on welfare. The issue of illegals back 25 years ago was nowhere near the crisis that we have now. You know, you would see people cross the border, they would get some water, they would keep on moving on, wouldn't try to harm you, wouldn't, you know, they were there to work. They were there to send money back. Now, granted, illegally, but they were there to work and send money back to Mexico. That money does not stay in the United States. So people who say it stimulates our local economy, that's because they've never lived in natural border cities.
No, I always thought we should tax that at some rate.
Yeah, right. You can consumption tax it and tax every unlawful person in this country. I mean, from cartels to black market. I mean, everything could be taxed if you just did a consumption tax and did away with the income tax. But that's besides the point. One of the big challenges in New Mexico with my niece, my sister owned a restaurant in this town of Deming. Their windows started getting broken. People were throwing rocks in, breaking into their restaurant and emptying their refrigerators and freezers, stealing anything valuable. And then she would find it on Marketplace. And some person who she would bring it to law enforcement, they would, you know, run a check and say, well, they're not from this country. And that became almost a daily occurrence. She didn't even sell her business. She shut it down. She said, I'm not in business to give this to. She employed 25 people. They're all out of work now. You know, another, and we could call this anecdotal, but another one of my buddies, born and raised in New Mexico, in Lovington, moved down to Las Cruces, where MS-13 and other gangs have infiltrated the city. They created tent cities ever since Grisham has became governor of the state. Now there's thousands of people. There's murders on a daily basis of homeless people killing each other. And illegals, because it's a sanctuary area, illegals that cannot be deported. They're not permitted to be deported. So these individuals are driving employment for those who want to be employed. Lower level employees are taking those opportunities away from them. They're doing manual labor, and everyday hardworking Americans for maybe their first job or two are now not employable because of these situations. Panhandling, which I think is their right. If somebody wants to stand up there and ask for a dollar, it's up to them to do so. It's, you know, their right to assemble, but it's up to the individual not to give the money, and they would immediately change that behavior. But now it's gotten to the point of, you don't give them that dollar, they're tackling you, they're stabbing you, you know, they're committing violence against you. It's gotten, and these are all individuals that are not legal people to begin with. The homeless people that are our vets that served our country now have so much competition that the soup kitchens can't serve them. They've ran out of funds, and they prioritize to give to illegals and not to soldiers. Or, you know,
this is certainly the image that we have of Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, not New Mexico. So I'm glad to hear you paint that picture, but I don't want to run out of time with you. So we do need to look fast forward to 2024. Ron DeSantis is the 46th governor of Florida, native Floridian with blue-collar roots. Ron attended Dundon High School and worked his way through Yale University, where he graduated with honors and was the captain of the varsity baseball team. He also graduated with honors from Harvard Law School. He was a JAG officer and defended SEALs in Fallujah, Iraq. His resume is awesome, no doubt. You have a website, readyforron.com. You were a big Trump backer, I believe, in 2016. How come DeSantis is your guy now, or do I have that wrong?
Well, I look at somebody that really can motivate voters, inspire voters to get behind the candidate. A candidate that has proven himself time and time again as the executive for this the state of Florida. Somebody that has served in the U.S. Congress, that understands how Congress works and how a state works and how budgets are actually critical. Imagine that. Somebody who served our country and somebody who understands small business and small business needs. Someone who's a lover of education, who has fought for that, and even from a policy legal standpoint, has fought for teachers in the state of Florida and the educational system in the state of Florida. I look at his resume, and yes, it's beautiful on paper, but more importantly, because we could have people that have beautiful resumes that do nothing. I've seen this governor go from a great resume holder to a phenomenal leader in our state during an extremely difficult time, and that was during COVID, where all these other states were frightened and were shutting down. DeSantis was opening up, and DeSantis was saying, I'm not here to put your small business out of business. You do what you see fit. And customers that are going into establishments, you shop where you want to shop and do what you want to do. And you know what? We didn't have rioting in the streets. We didn't have people breaking windows. We had people shopping and loving being an American. People that wore masks or didn't wear masks. It wasn't mandated. And there was love all across the state of Florida. We didn't have people fighting if somebody wasn't wearing a mask or somebody was wearing a mask. We respected one another. DeSantis brought these individuals together as in a true leadership fashion. So how could I not support him? To me, he is the only choice for our president in 2024.
And I saw that with my own eyes. I took my kids on a vacation during COVID anywhere we could go that did not have masks, Idaho and Orlando, Florida, to go to Disney World. So, yep, that is true. That is the way it was. There were people with masks, but that was voluntary. The new Morning Consult poll was out today, which it's an okay poll. I don't trust any of them except Trafalgar, but it has Trump 56%, DeSantis 23%, 3,808 registered voters, which is as good as you can get in polls. I know it's early, but what do you make of that poll?
I just liken it to back when Hillary Clinton was running and Obama was in last place and nobody was paying attention to him. I think there's a lot of runway here, and DeSantis hasn't even announced yet. And we have to look at that in the figures too. And Republicans, conservatives are casting their vote. Right now, he's not even in the race. So once he announces, I think you'll see those numbers become parabolic and straight up like a rocket ship, and he'll be the front runner.
Okay. You know, they've gone after guys like Mike Lindell pretty hard, the MyPillow guy, because of his association with Trump. Do you find being a Republican and when you were active in business, probably plenty of people you know who are on the DeSantis train, who are business professionals, have the money to help fund a campaign. Are they getting hurt in their businesses yet? Are they targeting DeSantis friends?
The whole cancel culture thing that we've seen, we allow that to frighten us. And that's the whole goal, right? Is fear. It's another World War II campaign. It's a campaign against conservatives this time. So we just have to stay true, plant our feet, and not wave. I mean, we can't waver to this type of culture. And the whole thing, if DeSantis taught us one thing, he taught us as conservatives to fight for what you believe in. Because he said the most unpopular things as governor, and he turned out to be right. almost every single time. But he took the chance because he believed in himself. So he said, I believe this. I'm not wavering. Maybe it hurts me, but I'm not going to get a poll to tell me how I should vote, how I should believe, and what I should say.
And I think he does handle the press very well.
He does. And he does not mind pushing back. I mean, he doesn't. He says it like it is, but he is respected. I mean, even from people that are opposite, across the aisle from him, respect him because they know when he says something, he believes in it, and he's willing to fight for it, just like he did for the Navy SEALs.
Yeah, and all that mud that they slung at him from the hostile press hasn't seemed to stick. It is seeming to stick on my governor at the moment, but we'll see. It's just been a couple weeks so far. But Trump said this, Ron DeSantis is a young man who is not doing well against me in the polls, to put it mildly. I believe that if he decides to run for president, which will only hurt and somewhat divide the Republican Party, he will lose the cherished and massive MAGA vote and never be able to successfully run for office again. What do you think of that statement?
I think President Trump is a fantastic marketer. And I think, the whole thing is get the attention back on you. And one thing we have to look at with DeSantis, what someone says to him is not going to sway him one way or the other. He's going to do what he believes in. And DeSantis has a following. Governor DeSantis announces that he's going to run for president, I think the whole discussion and the narrative about who's leading in the polls changes. And DeSantis will do the right thing one way or the other. It's up to him. But when we look at DeSantis from a policy standpoint and the fights that he has grabbed onto and won't let go until he's victorious, every single one of them were better for the taxpayers in the state of Florida and better for the electorate in the long run. So I think we all need, from a gubernatorial standpoint, everybody needs to find that DeSantis voice within them and start fighting. And just look at the clear victory. I mean, if we were gonna analyze the whole country, candidates that were backed by Trump that lost and candidates that weren't backed by Trump that lost all across the state, all different elections, and then compare that to DeSantis, a real clear victory with a state that he has with explosive growth. It's an amazing thing. I think we'll find that he's going to blossom. Just give him some time.
Okay. And how do you feel about the news, the mainstream media making a big deal out of the Trump DeSantis feud? Are they trying to knock Trump down or Ron, or do they not know what to do?
They need ad revenue, and boy do they miss a Republican being in the White House, because they have to do whatever they can, whether it's MSNBC or CNN or whatever. They need to do what they need to do to drive their ratings. Right now they're not doing well, so they have to start a fight wherever they can start one, whether it's imagined or not. They need to do what they need to do to drive their revenue. And I think viewers have really recognized that for the most part, and it reflects in the numbers of viewers. And they're tired of hearing that combat. We want solutions. I mean, viewers of programs want to watch it, and they want to hear, what is a solution to this? They want to look at somebody like DeSantis and say, he's presenting us with a problem and a solution to fix the problem. That's what I want to represent me in the White House. And I think his message is going to resonate with the majority. And I'd say moderate, I'd say blue dog Democrat, Republican, and independents. DeSantis is going to attract all of them, and his message is going to resonate with that group. We don't find that to be true right now with any other potential presidential candidate in the Republican Party. DeSantis does bring that to the table. And yeah, I think that's critical in 2024.
And they've showed their hand. I mean, the mainstream media, they basically shown the battle plan. You know, I didn't even remember that Vanity Fair was in business, but here's what they said. He's anti-free speech, particularly the kind of free speech that says the United States hasn't always been great for non-white people. He wants to make it harder for people to vote. He's dangerously anti-science. DeSantis apparently decided science was for suckers. We will never do any of these lockdowns again. I'm for that. Trust me, I hate them, but that's what they will try to make stick. How do you feel? How do you feel about this anti-free speech and anti-science handling of COVID attack?
Well, I think they need to look at themselves in the mirror and wear a mask, don't wear a mask. I mean, their first it was don't wear a mask, and then wear a mask, and then don't wear a mask. And you can look at science, and the scientists are right when it comes to global warming. They were wrong. When it comes to global cooling, they were wrong. Climate change, you can't be wrong because it's constantly a delta. It's constantly changing.
Right? The four seasons, yeah.
The scientists need to look at themselves in the mirror. The media needs to look at themselves in the mirror and realize that all they're doing is they're pushing a platform that they're in favor of, and it's not truthful. They want to push what they want to push. And what, you know, DeSantis, he knows what's right. And just because he disagrees with Fauci or someone else does not mean he's a science hater by any means. But he doesn't want data. Where he's really going is he doesn't want data to be manipulated as if voters are clueless and uneducated. He wants people to do their own research, find the facts themselves, and don't be force-fed information. Just because a media channel is telling you, or a story in the paper or on radio is telling you that he's anti-science, you can fact-check and see that you need to know who's trying to manipulate your thoughts and beliefs through their media and their channels.
And then, unlike Trump, who was saddled with Birx and Fauci and Redfield, DeSantis has a really wonderful, at least appears to be from afar, health commissioner. Do you know him? Do you have comments on him?
I have not worked, but one thing that DeSantis does, he picks individuals that he truly believes in, not that he was pressured to put into place. If we go back in history, we can look at a recent history. We question all of us, even as supporters of Trump. I supported Trump, and I don't now. Because I looked at it from a leadership standpoint, people were selected and put in positions that caused more problems than they did solutions. And because of that, that's a leadership issue in my eyes.
Personnel is policy, and if you have the wrong personnel, you're not going to be an effective leader. You're absolutely right. So that's good that DeSantis has surrounded himself with that. But any Republican will be better than, you know, what we have now. How has the DeSantis administration done on the ethical front? I'm not in Florida, so I wonder if he comes across as ethical, or does he have scandals the country might not like or to roll out?
He's been vetted from the day he took office. People have been digging and digging and digging. They do op research on day one if they think you're a potential threat presidentially or even gubernatorially. Chris's campaign team, former Republican, independent Democrat, researched DeSantis. The laundry has been aired. He's a loving father, a loving husband, stood by his wife's side and suffering with cancer, and refused to run for president because she had cancer, and he did not want to put his wife aside. He wanted to stand by her side instead. Serving our country, defending our Navy SEALs. You look at that, what he's done. I mean, defending teachers, giving raises to teachers. Imagine balancing a budget every single fiscal year, having excess funds to have a surplus. We have no idea as a country. Most states, look at every blue state out there. They're in financial crisis. Look at Chicago, Illinois, and New York, right? And you look at Florida. DeSantis, from an ethical standpoint, shines through fiscally. He's fiscally responsible. He runs the state like he would run his mom's checkbook and bank account, balancing it, taking care of it, and make sure more money isn't spent than what you have in the bank. And that's how he runs the state of Florida, responsibly. So is he ethical? Absolutely, he's ethical.
We got about 5 minutes left, so I want to get a few more out. You go on Fox a lot to talk about tax policy. That's your kind of claim to fame. Biden proposes $10 trillion in taxes that thankfully the new Republican majority won't even entertain, we hope. What would you like to see in a DeSantis tax plan to fix $31 trillion in debt, inflation, and everything out the door to Ukraine?
Well, I think that's a big issue, right? If we look at Ukraine and we look at involvement, I mean, if we dissect the budget and our expenditures, I mean, it's DOD, it's Social Security, it's Medicare, Medicaid. I think some of the things, the real critical things is when you shut down the government, what most people don't realize is all your critical services, nothing happens to Social Security, nothing happens to DOD, nothing happens to Medicare and Medicaid, but it works its way down to Department of Education, EPA, and things like that. What we need to be doing is drilling, getting more oil, selling that oil. We need to focus on the elimination of the Department of Education, and we need to put policies in place that are pro-small business. Because if you have pro-small business, they employ 60 million people. They employ the majority of people from the United States, not the gigantic corporations of the world like everybody's led to believe.
And I like how he took on big corporations like Disney and Pfizer in Florida. What's been the result of that fight?
Well, he's been victorious. I mean, people now came out from Glenna, where they were sitting on the board and Disney controlled every decision they had. And we, you know, look, the reality of it is corporations, regardless of size, small, medium, large, should not take a penny of taxpayer money. Winners and losers should not be selected because of friends in Washington, D.C. DeSantis fights against that. He took away a benefit that that went to Disney, and it's savings of $5 million+ per annum, per year. And he said, you know, that's not fair. Is a small business getting that same incentive? Absolutely not. They're neglected. But the employee, not what is it, 97% of all employees in the United States are small business owners. Put that money back in the pot, reduce taxes, and let everybody benefit from a lower tax system. And so, I think that's
okay. Thank you. GOP mega donor Ken Griffin, most people don't know who that is, gave $300 million to Harvard. Harvard is part of the problem, not the solution, in my opinion. He says it's time to move on from Trump and backs DeSantis also. Will we see all the big money now start moving to Ron?
You're going to see a shift. When everybody realizes he's running for president, then I think you're going to get major, you're going to have a handful of state with Trump. But as time goes on, I think you're going to see a major shift. And like I said, DeSantis's message will resonate with the majority. And that's what's going to allow him to get out of the Republican primary as the victor. And
well, we certainly need another morning in America. Let me ask you this last one. If Trump is the nominee, would you still back him?
Look, we are way, way too early for that discussion. I think we'll find that when DeSantis announces, the conversation is going to sound quite differently. And yes, I will definitely back DeSantis as our next president.
All right, Joe, thank you for your time. We appreciate you. We are at the end here. Please tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you and follow you if you're on social media. And I guess buy your cookies that you don't own anymore.
So this is a fantastic podcast, getting the messages out and getting the truth out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm James.
I'm Matt.
And I'm Ginger Stocky.
And we're watching the Mill Creek View Tennessee podcast. That was terrible.
Yeah. I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what did you think of our guest, Joe Sempervivo?
Yes, it's a very interesting show. And what a great story. A young man discovers he's got diabetes, and his parents and him go to work on finding cookies, and then they end up launching a business that became very, very successful. And they wrote a book. His children and others can read that and realize that not everything happens overnight. There's a history to what success in his family was. And I love that. And now he's applying that same work ethic and birth ethics to helping, well, Ron DeSantis, when he runs for presidency, he hopes to see the same thing take place. But he took that skill set, Steve, while he was in New Mexico and helped business grow. And boy, what an unfortunate story New Mexico has become, just like Arizona and other states near the border.
Yeah, really is. But Florida seems to be the land of promise, just like Tennessee. Okay, I can't claim this is fact, but it comes from a good source. Take it with a grain of salt anyway. But heir to the Rothschild family, Nathaniel Rothschild, today wrote to members of the British government giving his view that Vladimir Putin is the most dangerous man since the defeat of Hitler, with Xi Jinping a close second, and explained that Ukraine is an essential piece that we cannot afford to lose in the geopolitical chessboard. The heir to the Rothschild fortune argued that Russia must be exercised from the international banking and economic system. We must bring Russia to its knees through any means possible to send a strong signal to the Chinese and to protect our global system of norms and liberal values. We must be under no illusions. If we allow Vladimir Putin to seize Ukraine, it will send a signal to our enemies, Iran, China, and North Korea, especially, that we will not do nothing, that we will do nothing when faced with an onslaught of force. In effect, our current path of lack of military action means that our global order is dead on its feet. I urge you to deploy more forces against Russia and its proxies, step up information warfare to a correct opinion, especially online, and send weaponry to our friends in Ukraine. Without Ukraine, the global order may not survive. Clip number one, please.
Because everyone said, oh, I'm so nice to Putin. Putin said, if you're my friend, I'd hate to see you as an enemy. He told me that. I get along very well with Putin. By the way, I'd be able to work that out. It would have never happened in a million years. And even the Democrats admit that. But if this thing isn't solved by the time we have the election, which is possible it won't be, and there's also possible we'll be in World War III with these idiots that are doing what they're doing, you could end up in a nuclear world war, which will make World War I and World War II look like patty cakes, okay? This unbelievable, because we have people that don't know what they're doing. But if it's not solved, I will have it solved in 24 hours with Zelensky and with Putin. And there's a very easy negotiation to take place, but I don't want to tell you what it is because then I can't use that negotiation. It'll never work. But there's a very easy negotiation to take place. I will have it solved within one day, a peace between them. Now, that's a year and a half. That's a long time. I can't imagine something that happening.
The chairman.
Okay. Wow. That's
why they hate the guy. The globalist, neocon, warmonger, money changers, right?
Oh, well, we know that Rothschild is his instrument, which is the Economist, was on November 2018 put on that cover, which is you can find in my book. They told you exactly what was going to take place in 2019, as if they could predict anything. No, Steve, they pulled the whole damn thing off.
So Caitlyn Jenner has stirred the wrath of drag queen celebrities after the former Olympic champion publicly condemned the radical rainbow mafia. I like that phrase, claiming it is engaging in the grooming of children and is using violence to achieve its political goals. In an incendiary series of tweets on Thursday, Caitlyn Jenner didn't hold back when calling the rainbow mafia the worst thing that has ever happened to LGBT people and even domestic terrorists. Jenner appeared to be reacting to Monday's shooting in Nashville, in which a transgender individual gunned down six people, including three children, at a Christian school. We live in a beautiful country called America, where we are free to be whoever we want. The radical rainbow mafia has hijacked LGBT people and is the worst thing that has ever happened to LGBT people. They are domestic terrorists, he tweeted. Jenner later added, I don't consider grooming children a value. I don't consider violence to shut down opposition a value. The radical rainbow mafia is dangerous. I don't consider grooming children a value. I don't consider violence. I just said that. Caitlyn Jenner, March 30th, 2023. Let's be very clear. The radical rainbow mafia is a threat to peace and order. They are a fringe group of activists hijacking the LGBT population. It is an utter shame. It's beyond a shame. It's dangerous. March 30th, 2023. The radical rainbow mafia is a domestic terror group quickly becoming akin to white supremacist organizations. Not sure about that. To the people saying I started the radical rainbow mafia, you are wrong. I have been a celebrity since I made our nation proud in 1976. I had no choice as one of the most famous people in the world to be public with my decision. I use my voice responsibly. Radical LGBTQ activists have increasingly focused their efforts on promoting gender transitions for children, resulting in a growing number of young kids and adolescents suddenly identifying as transgender and non-binary. More states are pushing back against the trend, including Florida and Tennessee, which have banned sex change procedures for minors. In return, trans activists have claimed these laws are the equivalent of a genocide of trans people. Consequently, some trans people are calling for violent responses against those who oppose their ideology. Just days before the Nashville Christian school shooting, a mob of pro-trans protesters in New Zealand assaulted a feminist activist and her supporters to prevent her from speaking in public. Let's hear clip number two.
I just feel it's really sad, all the sexualization of our children right now, and we need to protect them, whatever that may be, like protect children, please.
Good.
Yeah, hard to hear, but that's Holly Holmes. Glad we got it to run. Calls out the sexualization of children after her UFC win tonight. It wasn't tonight. It was three nights ago. Study indicates gender transitioning worsens mental health outcomes in children. Northwest University psychology professor Michael Bailey conducted an analysis of survey data from 1,655 parents with young and young adult children identifying as transgender or non-binary. A recent study highlights that parents frequently feel pressured into allowing their children to undergo transitioning as a treatment for gender dysphoria, which may lead to worsening mental health outcomes in the affected young adults. Northwestern University psychology professor Michael Bailey conducted analysis of survey data from 1,605 parents with youth and adult children The group contends that transitioning does not lead to improved social and emotional functioning, adding that 78% of trans respondents reported having serious mental health issues as a child or teenager.
Steve, when are parents just going to be parents? When are they going to stop being so wimpy? I get tired of this. Steve, if I had a child that was dealing with some problems like this, I'd be out of my state and I'd be somewhere safe and I'd be dealing with it properly like a parent that loves my child, even to the point of giving my life for him.
Like your host. California School Board keeps policy that hides students' gender transition from parents despite pending litigation. Chico Unified School Board votes Thursday to keep a school policy which directs teachers to keep a student's gender transition a secret. So being a parent is not so easy. The vote comes after Aurora Regino filed a lawsuit in January against the Chico Unified School District after a counselor allegedly helped her daughter secretly transition genders. Quote, I'm still in awe about what I saw last night and how the board allowed people to heckle and bully parents who were speaking about the right to be involved in their own children's lives. This decision is devastating for parents, not only here in our community, but also across the country. The next step to fight back is legal action, and that's exactly what we're going to do, Regino said. A California school board voted Thursday to keep a school policy which directs teachers to keep a student's gender transition a secret despite pending litigation over the resolution. In a 3-2 vote, Chico Unified School Board decided to keep, quote, Administrative Regulation 5145.3, which requires educators to keep a student's change in pronouns or name confidential unless the student gives written permission for their gender change to be shared. Wow.
Wow.
Jack Clap Trap is endorsing RFK Jr. for president. Just kidding, but watch the video anyway. Clip number three.
CNN. Anti-vaccine quack Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has filed paperwork with the Federal Election Commission to run for president as a Democrat. In launching his presidential bid, Kennedy is the latest in a long line of family members to enter politics. So far, only Marianne Williamson, who last month launched her second long shot campaign, has entered the Democratic primary against Biden. Kennedy is such a health care menace. In 2019, even his cousins wrote an op-ed criticizing his anti-science views on life-saving vaccines.
Those cousins can just, you know, do what they want with that.
Anti-vaccine quack. Wow.
And I'll tell you,
Jake,
one of the things that I don't think.
Hold on that. Obviously, a biased.
Oh, journalist. Yeah. I thought they weren't supposed to. It's so. Steve, when we watched. Anyway, enough. Yeah, we know these guys are biased to the max. Yeah.
That one is. Tech titans, including Elon Musk, call for pause in advanced AI development amid profound risks. The Future of Life Institute's open letter emphasized the potential impact of AI developments on information channels, employment prospects, and the acceleration of AI surpassing human intelligence. Tesla CEO Elon Musk, Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, and numerous other technology leaders have requested a temporary halt on the advancement of powerful artificial intelligence, citing the potential dangers it poses to humanity. The AI language processing tool ChatGPT has garnered global attention as knowledge workers utilize its capability for tasks like composing emails and coding within seconds. The mass market AI breakthrough has spurred a competitive race among tech companies to integrate similar systems into their products and search engines. Elon Musk reportedly sees ChatGPT as, quote, training AI to be woke, and has sought alternatives from top researchers. Microsoft's recent announcement of integrating ChatGPT into Bing and Edge, and Google's plans to incorporate Bard, an experimental conversational AI service, into its search engines have intensified the conversation around AI systems. Anecdotally, I hear there are schools debating whether or not ChatGPT should be used for homework or not. That is insane.
Insane.
The letters suggest resonate with Western government's effort to establish ethical AI research standards. Okay, clip number four.
Things have been picked up a lot that's going to be a problem. And I had two calls yesterday, one from a county attorney in Kentucky and one from a county attorney in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. They were Republican, obviously. Both states are heavily Republican. They want to know if there are ways they can go after the Bidens now. And they've opened up a can of worms. They've set precedents now that we can't go back on. And now we're going to see a judicial system that's already bogged down with doing what they're supposed to do, and that's going after real criminals, people that are committing real crimes, burglaries, rape, robberies, things like that. And now you're going to start seeing ambitious political people like Alvin Bragg try to make a name for themselves and go after big pie-in-the-sky federal cases.
Okay, right.
And it's just not a good path that we need to go forward.
All right. At least two Republican DAs want to prosecute the Bidens, one from a county attorney in Kentucky and one from a county attorney in Tennessee. Comer, Republican Kentucky, told Fox and Friends. You just heard that. They were Republican. Obviously, both states are heavily Republican. They want to know if there are ways they can go after the Bidens now. Comer is leading a House Republican investigation into Joe Biden's role in his family's international business dealings in countries such as China and Ukraine. The lawmaker's staff recently reviewed suspicious activity reports filed by banks to the Treasury Department regarding possible criminal activity by the Biden family. We'll keep a close eye on that, not holding my breath. Joe Biden has been very slow to respond to the shooting of six people by a transgender radical in Nashville last week. He finally mentioned it, but only to use it to defend the two Democrat lawmakers expelled from the Tennessee legislature, not participating in the mob at the state's capital for participating in the state's capital, did not meet with the families or the two hero police officers who shot and killed the lunatic when Kamala Harris flew into Tennessee. So grandstanding everywhere. It's gross. Apparently, some insurrections are more equal than others. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. Welcome to my quotes for the day. A little different format this time, but before I share, happy 50th birthday, Scott. I also want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify or iTunes and hit the subscribe button and follow us. While you're there, go ahead and leave a comment. And thanks for doing it. This day, 78 years ago, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was hung naked at Flossburg for his failed assassination attempt of Adolf Hitler. A founder and member of the Confessing Church, Bonhoeffer was instrumental in organizing Christian resistance and calling the German church to action. In 1936, authorities banned Bonhoeffer from teaching at the University of Berlin. In 1937, Nazi shut down Bonhoeffer's Finkenwald underground seminary. In 1938, authorities announced that every German pastor had to swear loyalty to Hitler. In 1939, Bonhoeffer was given the opportunity to escape Nazi Germany and return to Union Theological Seminary in New York, where he was educated. He spent 2 weeks in New York and returned home, stating, "I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people." In April 1943, Bonhoeffer was arrested for helping smuggle 14 Jews out of Germany. He spent 18 months awaiting trial in Tegel prison, writing and ministering to fellow prisoners. On July 20th, 1944, an assassination attempt against Hitler titled Operation Valkyrie failed. Bonhoeffer was charged for knowing about the plot. On April 8th, 1945, he was court-martialed without representation and sentenced to death. The next day, Bonhoeffer was ordered to strip naked before being hanged. Hermann Fischer-Hulstrung, a Flossenburg prison doctor, described Bonhoeffer's last moments. "Through the half-open door, I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer still in his prison clothes, kneeling in fervent prayer to the Lord his God. The devotion and evident conviction of being heard that I saw in the prayer of this intensely captivating man moved me to the depths." Bonhoeffer's last words were, "This is the end for me, the beginning of life." A prophetic voice and fearless man who was fiercely committed to Christ, Bonhoeffer's writings and words still move and stir people to godly resistance. That's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, Joe Sempervivo, for Heart Healthy Light Cookies, available at Walmart and josephlightcookies.com. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of mcview.us. Peace in our time.
County Fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row of cotton and corn, moving through this place just like rolling thunder.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.